Enjoying our breath, flowing in and flowing out. And with a deep in breath, shanti, shanti, shanti. Satchidananda, a path for personal spiritual transformation. Something Reverend Donna talked about today, didn't she? Spiritual transformation. What I heard her say was, it's not something we need to do, rather something we need to uncover and let out and remove the barriers, the transformation that's already in place. Let's see, the last couple of weeks we looked at some slokas in the Bhagavad Gita that described what an enlightened person would be like. Remember that? Enlightened person. How do they talk? How do they walk? How do they sit? How do they stand? And we ended with some slokas coming up about how one might fall from that state. Would you like me to review those five slokas on an enlightened person? Before we get into...
I wasn't either.
Didn't get that? All right. Let's see if I find it. Here we go. I think there's five. 5, 6, 7, 8. That's five. All right. So we'll spend a few minutes on these slokas. An enlightened person. A person who has let go of all personal desires and is utterly content in the truth of the Atman, the true self, is one of steady wisdom. Donna today called the Atman, or true self, the spiritual center. Isn't that right? Person who has let go of all personal desire. She talked about that as well, didn't she? Letting go of. Accepting, with an E-X, and accepting. When we have a desire, we want things to be different. Accept. She talked about accepting, letting go of judgments, desires, things to be a particular way. The Bhagavad Gita begins with that as the first attribute of an enlightened person. Let go of all personal desires, who is utterly content in the center of that spiritual power within. Same message. 56. A person undisturbed by difficulties, who doesn't yearn to be happy, who has no favorites, no fear, and no anger, is a sage of steady wisdom. She talked about that as well today, didn't she? She talked about having sadnesses and being able to savor them. Remember that? When you have a sadness, and it consumes you, runs you, and you're not able to step back from it and savor it as part of life given to you, then it becomes a difficulty. A difficulty. who doesn't yearn to be happy, to take sadness when it comes and accept it for what it is, and savor everything life delivers. Who has no favorites, as we talked about that, no judgments. No fear, no anger, because one is centered in that spiritual center, which is unafraid of nothing. Not afraid of nothing. And not angry at anybody or anything, rather just is the source of light, which gives others permission to shine their light. 56, all right, 57. Whoever is free of all mental attachments, who is not excited when good things happen, nor dejected when evil comes, is poised in wisdom. Free of mental attachments. The same thing, mental attachments, being attached to outcomes, wanting things to be different than they are. Attachments, being attached to our bodies and our friends, and not willing to let them go when their time has come to go. Yesterday, there was a memorial service for Garnet Gamble. Garnet and Donna were like that for many years. They shared the same home, traveled, had a great relationship. And then it was over, and they remained friends. And yesterday, Donna was here to be in charge of the memorial service for her friend Garnet. Garnet Gamble. The grieving process is a natural process of letting go of any attachments that are still in place to some person. I noticed that in the grieving. I noticed that I had some attachments to particular opinions about Garnet, not all of which were positive. I had a mental attachment to those. They just had stuck in my mind. When I thought of Garnet, I thought of him as being an opinionated person. He was. And yet I was attached to that mentally without total acceptance or approval. So part of my grieving was to let go of that particular attachment. And I noticed others were letting go of their attachments to particular things they disapproved of in Garnet at the memorial service, as well as things that they approved of, and having him just be as he was. Free of mental attachments, who is not excited when good things happen, nor dejected when evil comes, rather living from the light of our divine essence. 57. 58. When one can withdraw the senses from sense objects, like a tortoise draws within, his wisdom is unwavering. When one can withdraw the senses from sense objects, our life is filled with sense objects, isn't it? Donna made a joke about it today in her sermon. She said that someone had on Facebook accused her of being a vegan. She said she had been a vegan at one time, but now she just ate what her body requested, which was mostly deviled eggs and nuts. In other words, she illustrated how she had withdrawn her senses from sense objects, and understanding that our bodies want certain kinds of food, or not actually our bodies and minds. Our minds and habits want certain kinds of foods. That's the senses. And Don had gone to a place where she looked deeply at what her body needed, not the things of sense objects, and found that what her body needed was deviled eggs and nuts, or whatever. And if you noticed, Donna's looking very trim these days. She was a little heavier when I knew her years ago. So I got the sense that she had developed a capacity to withdraw her senses from sense objects and rather go to a deeper place, deciding how to respond to life. Like a tortoise draws within, his wisdom is unwavering. By abstaining from sense objects, they will drop away. Longing for them will also disappear upon realizing the highest truth, sense objects. Jewelry, houses, automobiles, furniture, things. Even people. When we experience people as sense objects, we experience them through our judgmental, opinionated. When we remove ourselves from our sense object perspective and allow ourselves to just be the loving beings we are, through that consciousness, we accept others in that same loving space. And longing for differences or changes will disappear upon realizing the highest truth. I think that's it. That's five, isn't it? Okay, next there's some verses that talk about, well, what happens if we are in that state or heading towards that state? What can take us away? What can take us away? What do we have to be on guard against? So we ended here. As long as you're still striving to be in this state, an enlightened person, be extremely careful not to be deceived by overconfidence. I don't know if anyone here is feeling overconfident about their spiritual path. But here's a message for those who are thinking, I have achieved everything. Now I am completely in control.
Good luck with that.
You can be deceived at any time. And Lord Krishna gives a warning about it in the Bhagavad Gita. And the warnings are useful because to the extent we think we've done quite well in some areas, not in others, maybe these warnings will be useful. 60 through 63, three slokas about some warnings. If the senses become excited, Arjuna, they will carry away even the mind of a wise person aiming for perfection. My experience in life is no matter how peaceful and calm I am sometimes, at other times my senses just carry me away. I know when this is happening, it's because when my mind dwells on a subject and won't get off it, particularly during my meditation time. I've reserved a time for meditation and my mind just is going there. But what if this? And here's the way it should turn out. And if I do this, I'm going to do that, and they shouldn't have done. And the story repeats and repeats itself. In that sense, my senses have become excited and they carry away my mind. 61. But the yogi learned to control the senses by meditating on me as the highest goal. It's the same message that Jesus taught when he was asked, what is the greatest commandment? Remember that?
God with all your heart, all your mind.
Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart, all your soul, with all your strength, and all your mind.
How's that meditating on me?
Pardon?
But meditating on me, it depends on what they mean by me. And
this is the divine essence speaking, as if the divinity within us had a voice and came and talked to us and said,
oh, this is
this is Lord Krishna
speaking. Okay.
So for us to understand these things, if we just think of our divine essence as sort of a cloudy, unnameable thing, it's harder to get a handle. In the Gita, that essence is put into the voice of a man, Lord Krishna.
Okay.
So this is God speaking in the voice of Lord Krishna. Mm-hmm. But the yogi, the aspirant, learns to control the senses by meditating on me, the Lord thy God, as the highest goal. Isn't it interesting, when meditating, sometimes that's when our mind takes us away. And have we learned what's ours to do when that happens? What do we do when that happens? What spiritual practice have we learned when our mind gets distracted with a repeating story?
Do you really want an answer?
I have to teach this stuff, so I always have answers. You're welcome to have answers as well. I can give you an answer.
I don't know if it's an answer. I just know, for me, it's if I can sense I get is almost backing up, and if I can get a little bit of detachment from it, then I can sort of just, that's the space, that's the freedom. That little bit of detachment.
Yes. And this is what the spiritual scriptures teach us as well. In the Eastern tradition, it's interesting, you talked about a little detachment or perspective. They have a different set of words for what we call the mind. For us, the mind includes a lot of things. In the Eastern tradition, just like the Eskimos have different words for snow, we have one. We have one word for love.
Mm-hmm.
Some traditions have many. In the Eastern tradition, they distinguish between the Atman, or the self, the divine essence within us, the discerning intellect, which is what you call the perspective. The discerning intellect. We're not always in touch with the discerning intellect. Then the mind, which can wander. Sometimes we call that the ego mind. And then the senses, the feelings, and so on. And that's the recommendation. When the mind begins wandering, can you remember to notice the mind is wandering, and it's the discerning intellect that notices that. And just through the noticing of it, you open the door to letting go of the mind.
Sometimes it's so hard.
And sometimes the mind is so persistent, it's determined not to let go. In my experience, what to do then is to give thanks to the mind and give gratitude. Give gratitude for a beautiful mind that's doing its best, trying to perform its function, which is to support us and keep us in peace and lead us to safety where it perceives danger. It's doing its best, so be grateful for it. And the part of you that's grateful is, of course, your discerning intellect that's looking at the mind. That may be enough sometimes, and you're able to go back to your meditation. Oh, and mind just says, well, sorry, Charlie, I'm going to stay on this. And then that's the way it is. The yogi learns to control the senses by meditating on me as the highest goal. As the senses come under control, the yogi's wisdom becomes steady. The promise is, as we learn to control through the discerning intellect, eventually we will gain more control over our own minds. And the yogi's wisdom becomes steady. Now, and this is a commentary by Satchitananda, he gives a chain reaction that shows how people ultimately destroy themselves. Good morning. And it's a beautiful part of the Gita to remember always, a chain reaction. Good morning, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Steve.
Steve, I'm BJ.
BJ, you're very welcome. May I ask you a question, BJ?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar at all with the Bhagavad Gita?
In name only.
Name only?
Yes.
Okay, and what drew you to our class today?
I wanted to attend the service, and someone told me there's a class going on, so.
Here you are.
I was curious.
So, divine intervention and curiosity
perhaps.
Combined.
Perhaps, yes.
And here you are. You're welcome. We're right in the middle of looking at what it would be like to be in the presence of an enlightened person. What aspects of ourselves do we recognize as enlightened or lighter? Enlightened. The Bhagavad Gita talked about that. We just looked at it. Now it's giving us some advice about how we can be taken away from that state, what can happen in our lives that draw us away from that state. Now he, and this is Lord Krishna, incarnation of divine, gives us a chain reaction that shows how people ultimately destroy themselves. And our commentator, Satchitananda, says it's a beautiful part of the Gita to remember always. This is Sloka 62. From brooding on sense objects, attachment to them arises. And we just talked about brooding on sense objects. We talked about brooding on sense objects even during meditation or other times. And here, the scriptures are telling us, by allowing ourselves to brood on sense objects, attachment to them arises. That's interesting. I thought I was just attached to those things I was brooding about, and that's why I'm brooding about them. And the verse is telling us, oh no, you are brooding. And from allowing yourself to brood, attachment to them arises.
So it's this cause and effect. We have back, many of us have it backwards.
Could be. Could be. When our minds go off and just or something is bothering us, how do we hold that? Do we hold that as something that is, well, that's the mind's job, it's doing its best, I'll let it go and do that? Or do we hold it in a different way? So that we might regain mastery over the mind as something we have, rather than the mind is having us, which is what it feels like when we're looting on something. Subtle differences here. It's helpful to look at the subtle differences, because at such time when we're brooding on something, it's useful to have spiritual guidance to draw upon to deal with it. Here we go. From brooding on sense objects, attachment to them arises. Out of that attachment, personal desire is born. I can vouch for that. Going over and over something, the desire for a particular outcome gets stronger and stronger. Personal desire is born. And from desire, anger appears. Part of our natural humanity. I experienced this. Lately, there's been something I've been brooding over. I've desired a particular outcome, and I notice my body gets angry about it. Angry about it. It's part of our natural humanity. Anger confuses the thinking process, which in turn disturbs memory. Anger which isn't softened or held in perspective by the discerning intellect, but rather is allowed to grow, confuses the thinking process, which in turn disturbs memory. When memory fails, reasoning is ruined. And when reason is gone, one is lost. Sounds pretty dire. We see this, not in ourselves perhaps, but in others, where we see anger in people sometimes. And we see how their thinking process, at least to our way of thinking, isn't straight. The thinking process is confused, which in turn disturbs memory. People remember things other than the way they are. At Garnet Gamble's funeral service yesterday, one of his good friends was telling a story how they went to a bar. I'm sorry, they were at a conference and the food was free, but you had to pay for the beer. Garnet wanted a beer. He ordered a beer. He wasn't happy that he had to pay about it. He was angry. He ordered a second beer.
Wonder what outcome he expected.
He was just angry. Some part of him wanted the beer to be free, like the meal was free. It was a characteristic of dear Garnet. Later, when they checked out of the hotel, turns out he'd refused to pay for the beer at the time he bought it. He had some anger. At the time they checked out of the hotel, the conference was all over, they presented him with the bill for two beers. He said, I didn't have any beers. This is wrong, I'm not paying for this, I had no beers. So it happened to his memory, and they said, yes, you did. And his friend was standing there, he said, yeah, Garnet, you had two beers, aren't you? No, I didn't, he said, and I'm not paying for them, and he didn't. And it's still on his bill at the hotel, even though he's dead and gone. Bless his heart. Anger confuses the thinking process, which in turn disturbs memory. When memory fails, reasoning is ruined. And when reason is gone, one is lost. I'm guessing this is not an absolute. It's rather a slippery slope. A slippery slope. Do you need to leave at a particular time? Okay. This is the sloka, the Bhagavad Gita. Here's Satchidananda's commentary. Where does it all begin, he says? Brooding on a sense object. Oops. When you start brooding, you end up perishing. My goodness, I wonder how I could teach myself to stop brooding on sense objects every now and then. Yes, sir?
Could you define sense object?
Food, car,
material things,
my body, mm-hmm. yeah, something that I see,
yeah, our senses,
taste, hear, touch, feel, sense objects. Those are sense objects.
If you want a certain outcome, we talked about that earlier, if you desire a certain outcome, how's that a sense object? Because indicated that too could lead to down the slippery slope.
That's a good question. No answer comes up for me right away. I do know there are two aspects to our spiritual practice, and one is getting some perspective from sense objects, some detachment, and the other aspect is recognizing when desires crop up for outcomes and how that takes us away from living as our true selves in the moment and rather puts us in a place to be upset. Because if you have a desire, there's two possibilities. The desire's met, oh, I'm happy. The desire's not met, I'm angry. The scriptures teach us that either outcome is corrosive. Even when our desires are met, it's not truly satisfying. What is truly satisfying is when we act in the moment, and we act for the action's sake. We act as Spirit guides us and be at peace with that and let go of the future.
The outcome.
The outcome. And be willing to accept whatever the universe delivers. Let go and let God, it's often said. If I think about it, I might find the relationship there. Mm. Those are two areas that we have to be on guard about. Attached to sense objects and inadvertently being attached to things turning out a certain way. If I do this, talking about cause and effect, then this is the way it ought to turn out. Good questions. You stumped me. Where does it all begin, he says rhetorically, brooding on a sense object. When you start brooding, you end up perishing. Well, we know brooding does have two aspects. Brooding, we can't brood on a particular thing, but we can also brood on a thought or an outcome. Here's an example. He's going to give an example. You go to work every day by the same road. You see many people coming and going along your way, but you don't even notice them. All of a sudden, one form gets registered in your mind. Ah, who was this lovely woman? Now, ladies, you can visualize, ah, who's that hunk? Attractive hunk. Then you walk on. But something is fixed there. Something is fixed. Who could that be? The next day you happen to see the same woman and your interest grows a little more. Within a couple of days you desire to find her address and telephone number. Or do something provocative to attract that hunk to talk to you. Whatever you do. You're hoping for a date. My wife can tell you about this. When we first met, I asked her out to date, and she said no. No. Turns out we were both working in the government. She worked for the government. I was a contractor. And she was startled, but also she wasn't sure that government people should go out with contractors. Anyway, she asked around at her work, and they told her, Janice, I said, don't you know about so-and-so, contractor, or government person? They go together. She said, really? Yeah. No big deal. Ah. Then she was hoping for a date, but I didn't know that, did I? Anyway, eventually she got her date through doing what women do, being very friendly. You hope for a date, and you're hoping for a date. Somehow you come to know that someone else is already courting her. Ah, this is a different development. Someone's already courting her. Because you are mad for her, an enmity develops, and you want to destroy the other suitor.
We're moving very fast, aren't we?
So there's just no love among the elite. They never fall in love with them.
Not a lot of time for these stories. We're almost done. You get into a terrible fight. The law doesn't understand that it comes from a mental fixation. And you both are put in jail. Life gets ruined.
Who does she visit?
She goes and finds another dude who's not in jail.
Anyway, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Right when life gets ruined.
Yeah, just
and happily marries
the son. Take your mental fixations. This is what happens.
And so the lesson is, from this example, avoid looking at women?
No, just do so noticing that you have a mental fixation. And it is part of your human nature.
Awareness.
And rather than let your mental fixation run you, you run your mental fixation and be grateful for it and thankful that part of your nature is to have
appreciation
or lustful feelings, attraction feelings is part of human nature. And yet not to let that run us in the sense that if you pursue that in a natural way and something gets in the way of it, okay.
What can I learn here?
Yes. What can I learn here? Right. And this is what I have learned to do at the time that I asked her on that date. I thought about it quite a bit, so I was all prepared when she showed up. She wasn't prepared. Before, if I asked someone on a date and they said no, I was crushed, especially as an adolescent. I'd ask a girl on a date and she said no, I was crushed. And I had an inferiority complex, as we used to call it back then, in that moment about not being accepted, not being loved, not being wanted. I wasn't willing to look at the other person, put myself in their shoes and see what was going on with them and see that perhaps their refusal had nothing to do with me, but it had something to do with them. As an adolescent, I didn't do that. But as I'd gotten older, I learned, you just put it out there, and if you get accepted, great. If you don't, great. So after she turned me down on the date, I was walking out to the elevator, and she was standing by the elevator.
This is Janice, your wife?
There she is.
Oh, okay.
There's Janice, my wife. Mm-hmm. And she turned me down for the date, and there she was standing by the elevator. Well, in my new consciousness, I was okay with that. And I said, hi. And I said, look, I hope I didn't offend you by asking on a date right away. I said, let's just be friends. My new consciousness. She said, oh, that's okay. She pushed that down button. No, push that down button. It's not a friend. She kept pushing that down button. She wanted to get in the elevator. And I said, all right, we'll just be friends. So in my mind, that was our relationship. She didn't want to go on a date, no big deal. We'll just be friends. I had other women friends. I'd learned how to have women friends instead of just men friends. And it took some doing on her part to change my idea of being friends to something more.
Well, I was in the government and he was the contractor.
Right.
And I didn't think I could go out with him. And so I had to ask my supervisor.
Almost permission, yes. But you hadn't shared that the reason with him, right? See that? Mm-hmm. If women or potential partner, objects of our attraction would just share some information, I'd love to, but I can't, or I'm with someone, or some information that would help a lot towards not feeling that.
It would help if people weren't human and acted in a way that just worked for us instead of acting in the ways that worked for them.
Yeah.
There you go.
And I had to flirt with him a lot afterwards to get him to finally ask me out again.
Because he had blinders on at that point. She's just a friend.
Just a friend, right.
I don't want to cross that line.
Don't date friends.
Yes. So.
That's a good story. Anyway, we didn't get into a terrible fight, and life, instead of getting ruined, got better.
Right.
Success.
Everything begins with the mind. My goodness, that's the sermon that Reverend Donna told us this morning, isn't it? Everything begins with our consciousness, is the way she put it. When the mind becomes attached to something, you don't usually question the mind. Without some spiritual training, we don't question the mind. You don't analyze it. The mind wants it, so you just chase after it. Mind wants it. That's what's meant here. Not that you should totally avoid looking for good friendships, but let the desires be under your control. See the desires from your discerning intellect, not from your ego mind that wants certain things this way and not other way. As desires for this and aversions to that. Yes, that's in our ego mind. We also have a discerning intellect. And if we can look at our mind from our discerning intellect, then the desires are under the control of who we really are. Just that deep capitalist self. The deep capitalist self uses the discerning intellect to put everything the mind is doing in perspective.
I missed that. The deep what? Self?
You can look at your consciousness as having three levels. Mm-hmm. It's a way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. The ego mind, which wants this, and doesn't like that, feels this way, doesn't feel that way. A discerning intellect, which discerns things and stands back a little bit, stands back and notices what's going on without getting involved. And then at a deeper level, there's what Reverend Donna today called our spiritual center, our spiritual essence, our Christ consciousness. In the Eastern teachings, it's called the Atman, or capital S self. Many words for the same thing, which probably doesn't have a good name. Some divine, childlike, playful, joyful essence that is in us from the day we're born and stays until the day we die. And even though we may cover it up with layers of barriers, the teaching is it's always there. It's always there. Can we, from our spiritual essence, our capital S, so call upon our discerning intellect.
Now I heard our capital S self.
Capital S self is the Christ consciousness,
right,
or Atman.
Right.
All right. Can, from that deeper essence of who we are, call upon our discerning intellect. Take a step back. Can you step back from your own mind? And thus understand all things. That's the discerning intellect.
Thank you.
Just one of the things that I have found is that if I can, you know, when I am able to get that little bit of distance and detach, then what helps me is if I can separate the feeling from the thoughts. And if I can separate, because the thoughts, it's like a vicious circle. The thoughts are feeding the feeling, and the feeling's feeding the
reinforcing.
Yeah, it's awful. So if I can just feel the feeling without the commentary, that helps a lot, because then the feelings dissipate much more quickly.
Yes.
Because they're not getting, and then that helps, you know, self with a big S to get even more discerning and figure stuff out better. But man, sometimes it's sticky. It's real sticky.
It's a wonderful observation. Can we separate the feeling from the mind? Did you know there's a whole school dealing with our ability to make that separation? It's called nonviolent communication, developed by Marshall Rosenberg. Learning techniques for separating the feelings from the rest of the mental chatter, and by separating, getting the ability to see things in a new, more neutral light, along with the feelings and the mental chatter, NVC, nonviolent communication.
I also like what you added to that, which was by disengaging the gears, they're not reinforcing each other.
Yes. As long as they're engaged, feelings are tough in the sense that they don't just reside in our mind. Our mind isn't just up here. Our mind has tentacles that reach throughout the body. So if the mind has a feeling of sadness, that feeling of sadness may be transferred to the throat and we choke up.
And
the chest. And to the eyes, which tear.
Sometimes
we have a feeling of anger, it may result in muscle movement. So the mind isn't just up here. It stores feelings all over the body, making it more difficult to notice they're just feelings.
Yeah, and that's what I find. Sometimes it's such a glob up there that just to feel the feelings is quite a challenge. So sometimes for me, I'm finding if I can just feel where it is in my body, that helps.
We're going to call it close now so we can go to church. Yes.
So,
noticing where the feeling is in your body, is
yeah,
what I heard you
helps.
Say?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That helps me identify it, figure it out.
Right. We have a bit more here, but it's time to close, so those going to the service can go to the service. We'd like to begin and end these classes by taking ourselves down into the capital S self. And we do that by making the sound of Om together. We'll prepare for that by taking three conscious breaths together. And with a deep in breath, go in peace.